May it please the court, counsel. I'm Chris Engold, appearing here on behalf of Tomas Gonzalez, the appellant, and Cross Appellee. This case is before this court because of a denial of justice because the defendants invited error in the trial court. They persuaded the trial court to depart from sound rules governing jury instructions and verdict forms. They persuaded the trial court to deny the plaintiff a new trial after the jury verdict was rendered that would have been limited to just damages. And they persuaded the trial court before the trial started to allow an improper balance in the case below that favored the defendants at trial and unfairly prejudiced the rights of the plaintiff. And that they persuaded the trial court to allow a motion for summary judgment that was tardy to be filed and had to be responded to on an expedited basis on the eve of trial.
So what are the things that you would have done that you were precluded from doing because of the late filing of that motion? There's nothing specific in the papers that I saw.
Well, that's true. And, you know, I can simply tell you that I've pulled a lot of all-nighters in my stint as being an attorney, not out of choice, but it happens occasionally. I have never been so tired as I was at the start of that trial. And I know that's anecdotal, but I think the comments to the rules that I cited in my brief, they talk about hardball litigation tactics that are intended to beat a party into submission. And I can tell you, I about passed out that first day of trial. I was so exhausted. I felt beat into submission. And I think that's what the comments are referring to. That, you know, I understand that I didn't get that much into the record, but I did preserve my objection to the departure from Rule 16 and the court's own trial order. And, you know, there's a lot that happens right before trial. You want to work with your witnesses so that you understand how they respond to questions so that you can elicit the truth from them for the jury. You want to make sure that you've gone through your jury instructions so that you can catch any mistake, a typographical error or an error of law. You can refine it. You can practice your presentation. All of that, Your Honor, was out the window, because if you look at the amount of response that had to be done to the motion for summary judgment and the other motions that were filed, this was not a light matter. Essentially, what was being suggested to the court, and so please understand, I'm not blaming the trial court for determining that there was a need to respond to the allegations in the motion for summary judgment. The motion essentially alleged that a fraud was being perpetrated on the court. If you read their motion, I think it was impingent upon the trial court to require a response to that before trial. I just don't think that the court should have done that in an expedited fashion and then made the trial proceed when it was a departure from the discretion that the rules provide.
I can't remember from the briefs. Did you file a motion to continue the trial?
I'd have to look at my objection to their motion for leave to file, and I can address that in reply. I believe I incorporated the substance of that idea in the response to their motion, but I can't, you know, pick that out right now. But I will research that and deal with that in my reply time. I think what the import of what I was trying to tell the court in that response was, look, this is a departure from the rules. It's not permissible. It's going to prejudice me at trial. And even if I didn't specifically say, you know, deny it or on the alternative, give a continuance, I believe that's a fair reading of my response, was that this was going to be incredibly prejudicial. And so I think implicit in that is that if the court desired a response, they needed to relieve me of that prejudice, which the courts have repeatedly said the way you relieve a party of prejudice is you give a continuance. But I can't say if I actually use that phrase or not, but I will research that.
If you didn't ask for a continuance, then you didn't, the court didn't deny something that you asked for.
Well, they did deny the requirement that the rules be followed. That's the procedural problem in terms of the motion for summary judgment and the motions in limine, because the rule is really specific. You can't file the motions when they filed them. And the comments to Rule 16 are also explicit. This is why we don't let you do that. And so I think, you know, the court had to have a good cause reason to depart from that rule. And in the record, there is no good cause finding from the court to allow a departure from Rule 16 in the court's own trial order, pretrial order.
But your argument then is that the court erred in not enforcing the filing requirements, time filing requirements of Rule 16?
Yes. And as I stated in the opening brief, you know, like in the Valdez case, when the court departs from the rules, it's an abuse of discretion and it's prejudicial.
An abuse of discretion is different from what you've argued on appeal. On appeal, you've said this is a constitutional violation, violated your due process.
Well, yes.
Those are two different things, two different standards of review, and I don't see where you made that argument in the trial court, the due process argument. You clearly made an argument under the language of the rules, but that's not a constitutional argument. And so what are we dealing with here?
I would have to look at my response so that I'm make sure that I'm being clear, and I will make sure I do that in my reply time. I do believe that the argument that was made to the court is that the rule had to be followed. And until the court issued its order saying, no, you're going to have to respond anyway right before trial, there's at that juncture, there's just enough time to go ahead and comply with the court's order and continue your trial preparation. There's only so much time. And so
unless you specifically ask for a continuance of the trial.
Sure. And I'll look at that response and address that in reply. That is one of the three main areas that I raised to this court about problems with the decision below. But I think something that's a little more obvious and direct is that despite all this, we had a jury find in favor of my client. And yet my client ends up paying the costs and being found to not be the prevailing party. And I think it's useful to actually look at the verdict form that was issued by the jury, because the jury was asked, has the plaintiff proved by a preponderance of evidence that fraud was committed? Yes. Did the plaintiff have injury, damages, or losses? Yes. Was the alleged fraud a cause? Yes. Was Fort Collins at fault? Yes. Was Fort Collins' fault in cause of the damages? Yes. So you read this verdict and say, okay, they found that he has damages. The damages were caused by the defendant's conduct. And then you get to the damages and then zero. And so, you know, under the standard understanding of a plaintiff has a right to damages when a jury finds in his favor, all that case law that I cited in the brief, it should be a no-brainer that the trial court should have simply reversed. But the loyal opposition, opposing counsel, is intelligent and persuasive and invited the court to err.
Counsel, did you object to this special verdict form?
Yes. I specifically mentioned to the court that the standard Supreme Court approved verdict form had a line for the plaintiff in terms of percent of damage, so that when they're doing mitigation, they don't make the mistake of
that's a different issue. I think we're talking about damages, not about fault. My question was addressed to whether you objected to the damages aspect here. And this says, after he goes through the part that you read, paragraph 7 says, what is the total amount of plaintiff's damages, if any, for non-economic losses? And it goes through that for economic losses and for physical losses. Each time it asks, if any. So the jury, didn't that empower the jury to say zero for each of those categories? Either because it was de minimis, or maybe he thought that you had failed to mitigate your damages. The jury thought you'd failed to mitigate your damages.
I think that's exactly what they did, and that's the point that I raised with the trial court. If you don't put in that percent line for the plaintiff, where you have the percents for the defendant, they're going to make a mistake and think mitigation's an absolute defense. And the words of the trial court were, I don't think they're going to make that mistake. But that deviation...
We're talking, the counsel, aren't you confusing damages with fault? Those are two totally different things, aren't they?
They are,
because the special verdict form is addressed to it allocates fault between Fort Collins and the defendant, the other defendant, excuse me, and
right.
But it does not. It's just allocating fault between defendants. You're saying that fault should have been allocated to the plaintiff?
Well, Fort Collins was a non-party at fault.
I understand.
Okay. So you have the defendant, you have a non-party at fault. Why not put the plaintiff in there? Are those things different, the idea of damages and fault, are they different? Not in the mind of a confused jury.
What case law is there that says that you look at plaintiff's fault in an intentional tort case? This was, I understand, was fraud by deceit, which is, I think, by definition, an intentional fraud.
I mentioned those statutes in the opening brief. I don't have them.
Yeah, but those are all talking about comparative negligence. We're not talking about negligence.
Well, there's two. One is,
and they do talk about comparative fault, but there's case law that specifically says that, as I recall, cited by defendants, that comparative fault does not apply to intentional torts.
I'll look at that. I don't think that's correct. I think that's a misstatement of the law. And I think the statutes are explicit. There's two separate statutes, both of which would support the verdict form. And even if there were no statutes, the case law on your entitlement to a correct statement of the law says that if you're not given that, prejudice is presumed. Confusion is presumed.
And that's just that they're statement of law.
Well, the verdict form that is approved by the Supreme Court has a line there for the percentage of the plaintiff's fault, which is exactly what I asked the trial court to put in, and the court said, no, I don't think they're going to make that mistake. I'm not going to put that in. So, I mean, if you read that exchange in my opening brief from the trial transcript at the very, you know, the very day the verdict is going to be submitted, I'm like, you are. You've got to put in that line, and if you looked at the Supreme Court approved form, it's got that line in there, and I'm saying, Your Honor, put that in there. And he says, no, I won't do it.
And so what would have happened, if they did it the way you did, they would have said, let's say they gave a third to to your client, a third to Fort Collins, and a third to CCMSI, and then they awarded $3 in damages. So that would have reduced their award by $1. But here they're saying $0, so it doesn't matter how you divvy it up.
Well, we don't know, I believe, because of the confusion for the jury, and I think the case law supports me. When you have a wrong instruction, confusion and prejudice is presumed. I don't believe we really know what the damages were that the jury said would occur. Because if you look at the verdict form that they filled out, which is page 3,587 on the CD, they said, yes, he had damages as a result of the conduct of the defendants. But then they award zero. Zero is not damages.
Mr. Engel, you have less than a minute left.
Yes, Your Honor.
I just want to remind you.
I think I should preserve that less than a minute.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Good
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Doug Thomas. I represent the defendants here, Cannon Cochran Claims Management Services, Inc., and Shirin Chowdhury. From our perspective, from the defendant's perspective, all of the arguments concerning due process, concerning the jury verdict, and concerning the other errors are irrelevant. From our perspective, the trial court should not have submitted the case to the jury and should have granted our motion for directed verdict in the first instance. We think the case is a simple, very, very simple case, and that is a fraudulent misrepresentation case. A purported fraudulent misrepresentation arises out of a single letter issued January 23, 2004, by an attorney for the City of Fort Collins. And in that single letter, there is a single statement that contains 22 words exactly. And that is that the City of Fort Collins has also destroyed its copy of the 1995 claim file in the ordinary course of business. And the fact is that the attorney who wrote that letter, who made that statement, said that that statement is absolutely a true statement. And in fact, during the course of the entire trial, there was never any evidence that that statement was in fact false. That the plaintiff here, Mr. Gonzalez, said he had no personal knowledge of whether that claim file existed at the time that statement was issued in 2004. Mr. Gonzalez, the plaintiff, testified that he never talked to anybody at the City of Fort Collins about that claim file, and he testified he never spoke with anybody at Cannon Cochran Claims Management Services about that file. Mr. Gonzalez never testified he was deceived in any way by that statement. You have a true statement with no evidence that that statement's false and no testimony by the plaintiff that he was even deceived by that statement. In response to our motion for directed verdict, the plaintiff argued that the jury could determine the author of this statement's credibility, and because of that, the directed verdict should be denied. And the judge did deny it for that reason. That's wrong. The case law is clear and unambiguous, and in particular, I'm referring to the Park Rise homeowners case cited in my brief, that credibility of the witness is not an issue for a directed verdict. If that's true, directed verdicts would never be granted. In fact, you could also always say, let's put the witness up, let's put the defendant up on the stand and see if a jury believes him or not. No. The directed verdict is whether all the evidence taken together could show that a jury could rule for the plaintiff, and a jury couldn't rule for the plaintiff here because the statement was true, because the author said it was true, and there was zero contrary evidence showing it was false. Zero.
Help me with something. This was a statement made in a letter by the attorney for Fort Collins?
True.
What does that have to do with your client?
I have no idea at this point. And it's an argument I made repeatedly over and over and over to the trial court. But that attorney, in a subsequent case, also represented my client. In essence, the City of Fort Collins had two agents. They had an attorney agent who helped them give advice on litigation matters, including workers' compensation. And they had my client who performed an agent service for the City of Fort Collins, which is that of a third-party administrator for the workers' compensation claims, and certain workers' compensation claims. The attorney, when he wrote this letter, CC'd my client on the bottom of the letter, and that was my client's relationship to that letter.
The trial court addressed that in its ruling on the directed verdict motion, that argument?
Did not. It was part of our summary judgment motion. He did not rule on that part as to the directed verdict. He did not make any statements. He just said the motion was denied. He didn't explain his reasoning at all in denying the motion. There were arguments about the jury instructions as to an apparent authority and actual authority, and over our objections, he did give an apparent authority instruction to the jury. But ultimately, it's difficult to determine whether that apparent authority instruction was correct or not correct. But that is the relationship. My client is the third-party administrator for certain cases for the City of Fort Collins, and Mr. Campbell is an attorney that advises the City of Fort Collins. So they're two agents doing different services for a principal. So our main contention, Your Honor, is that the directed verdict should have been granted. In any event, even assuming that it was proper to submit the case to the jury reached the right result. At least they reached a result that I think should be affirmed on appeal. And that result is that ultimately my client prevailed because they found that the plaintiff suffered zero damages. The argument here that the verdict is inconsistent, I think, is not true. First of all, it's not supported by the case law from our Supreme Court. Lee's Mobile Wash, I believe, is directly on point. And Lee's Mobile Wash from the Supreme Court specifically says that when damages are contested, it is perfectly acceptable for a jury to find zero and award zero. And I think it's also supported by the case law from the Tenth Circuit and other cases which find that a jury can, in fact, award zero when there's a failure to mitigate instruction because it's presumed that whatever damages they would have awarded were entirely due to his failure to mitigate. So I think the jury verdict is consistent in that regard. So our basic position is that it shouldn't have been submitted to the jury in the first place. And even though it was, ultimately my client prevailed in a way that was consistent and can be reconciled.
What kind of damage evidence, if any, was presented by the plaintiff during trial?
None. In fact, I objected to that and asked for a directed verdict on that as well. The ultimate claim, if you want to make the long and attenuated chain of events here, is that somehow the city of Fort Collins possessed a claim file. That claim file contained a legal document which would have awarded him medical care. That had a guy been able to, because he didn't get that document, he was unable to get medical care for his neck. The question is what's the value of that, if that's what you're asking? And the answer is there was never any evidence presented of what the value of that medical care would have been. What they tried to do is introduce evidence from other claims and other documents to bootstrap that. And at one point, I will concede that over my objections, Mr. Gonzalez testified that it was his understanding that an office visit cost $200 to $300. Other than that, there was zero evidence of any kind ever submitted to the jury in terms of what the damages would be for Mr. Gonzalez. And I objected to any document that came in. I objected to any hearsay testimony about that. And I even objected at closing argument to any references to damages because we believed he failed to show any damage of any kind. There was no evidence of what that would be. There was no economic expert. There was no one from a doctor's office testifying. They didn't have a doctor say what this is. There was nobody. On the other hand, you know, our experts, both industry standards experts and medical experts, our experts testified that that document wouldn't have awarded him benefits in the first place. That most likely, given all the evidence surrounding the circumstances, that document would never have awarded him future medical care. Even if it did award him future medical care, our medical expert said he didn't need any medical care, didn't need it then, and still doesn't need it today, and in his opinion, was never going to need it as a result of the injury. So we had both industry standards experts saying that there was no award of future medical care, and a medical expert saying he didn't need any anyway. So even if you assume that somehow he didn't get this piece of paper, the piece of paper had no value. It had no value because it didn't award him anything, and it had no value because it didn't need any medical care. And on top of that, he failed to introduce any evidence of what that value of that would be.
So you're really talking about no evidence of amount of damages.
That's true. Or that it had even any value. You can...
No, I mean, you had the jury saying, yes, this plaintiff suffered damages, and yes, the damages were caused by the defendants. So, and then they put zero. So it seems to me you got to be able to explain that zero somehow. One way, I suppose, is to say, well, there's no proof as to what the amount is.
True.
A second way is he didn't mitigate his damages. But you got to deal with that in some way.
True. I actually think there's a number of ways. So let me see if I can walk through them. First is you can say that these pieces of paper, that there's a physical loss. You lost two sheets of paper. So there's a damage. But it has no value. It has no economic value. So you can absolutely find that. And that's the very first way is I think that what the jury was saying is there's a physical loss. He didn't get his piece of paper. but it has no value because it didn't award him anything. It didn't award him future medical care, and therefore it's zero. Then I think you can go on to say that even if that physical loss, two sheets of paper, awarded him future medical care, it's irrelevant. It has no value because he didn't need any medical care based upon our expert witness. And then the third way you could deal with that is to say, even assuming that this loss of two sheets of paper awarded him future medical care, and even assuming he needed some medical care, he failed to prove the value of that care. So I think there's three levels, there's three ways of explaining why a jury could say that loss of two sheets of paper has no value. It didn't award him anything. Even if it did award him anything, he didn't need it. And even if it awarded him something and he needed it, it had no value, or he failed to prove what that value was. And then the fourth and final way is to say whatever that value was, he failed to mitigate it. So I think there's actually four ways to get to exactly where the jury got to. There's a damage, a loss of paper. And then, by the way, the verdict form is injuries, damages, or losses. Two sheets of paper were lost or not provided, but they have no value. So I think there's four ways to get there.
How do you know it's two sheets of paper if you can't find a document?
Well, that's a good question. Having looked at a number of those documents over the years, I believe now the standard division form is a little more than that. It's about eight sheets. But at the time, I believe the standard form was two to three pieces of paper. If you believe that it's only the critical legal document, which was the final admission of liability, I believe the division is two to three sheets. So yeah. That's the way we see it. That's how a jury could get there. So with that, I think my arguments are concluded for today, unless there's some other questions. Thank you.
Your Honor, I do have an answer to your question. I want to get to it, but first, I have to say that counsel's attempt to retry the case here is interesting, but irrelevant to the fact that prejudice occurred to my client. And, you know, we could argue facts all day long. Those two little sheets of paper are called final admissions of liability. They award benefits in the work comp system. It was submitted to the jury that one of them that we could find was worth $230,000 or more in medical care. And the presumption was that the reason why the earlier one was lost was so that they could dodge that. That and many other aspects of evidence were presented to the jury. In terms of the motion,
Mr. Engel, I see your time has expired. Thank you.
Okay.
Counsel, thank you for your helpful arguments. This matter will stand submitted, and the court will issue an opinion in due course.